This podcast is produced by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society. CDSS provides programs and resources, like this podcast, that support people in building and sustaining vibrant communities through participatory dance, music, and song. Want to support this podcast and our other work? Visit cdss.org to donate or become a member today.
One and a half around. Now below one, couple and forward six.
Look around to the right when you're balanced. Look around to your right and you balance once again.
Swing your partner. Nod your quarter element left to left. Hand back to your partner, right, left, right hand. Over hand, around, left. Then meet your partner, promenade.
Everybody, swing your partners off.
Hey there, I'm Mary Wesley, and this is From the Mic, a podcast about North American social dance calling.
Nicely done.
Today we're taking a little trip to Boston. Well, Newton, Massachusetts, to be more precise. Back in September, I went down to the Boston area to call the Bida Dance. That's the Boston Intergenerational Dance Advocates, if you don't know. And I paid a visit to the Rosen household. A leading caller of contras, squares, English country dance, and family dance programs, Sue Rosen has been actively calling for 30 years in the Boston area, across the country, and overseas. She's built a collection of great dances and has written contras that have become part of the standard repertoire of dance callers across the contra dance world. Sue and her husband Bruce, who you may know as one of Boston's most treasured country dance musicians, were so kind to welcome me into their dining room for this interview. Sue and I talked about the central role of the traditional dance community in her and her family's life. She filled me in on the landscape of the Boston dance scene as she's experienced it over the years, including stories about two of her most significant mentors, Ted Sinella and Larry Jennings. She shared her personal thoughts and philosophy on calling, choreography, and working with musicians. And we also looked to the future, considering what lies ahead as we continue to navigate the interruption of the pandemic. Again, we recorded this conversation in person at Sue's dining room table, so you may hear some background noises from time to time. I'm delighted to share our conversation with you. Sue Rosen, welcome to From the Mic, and thank you so much for welcoming me into your home. You're one of few people that I've gotten to visit in person, so I'm in town to call the Bida Dance later today, and I asked if I could drop by and chat, so thank you.
Thanks, Mary. This was very short notice, and I'm glad that I had some time this weekend and that I actually got to see you in person, face-to-face. What a novelty these days.
Absolutely. It's wonderful. And thanks for making the time. It was definitely a bit whimsical. I was like, oh, I wonder if I could fit in an interview. And then, miracle, you were free. So, do you want to just start out by telling me a little bit about how you found
Sure.
your way into the world of social dance and how you eventually got up on stage with a mic telling people
Yeah.
what to do?
Well, I've always been a dancer. I've always been interested in dance, from ballet lessons as a little kid to Israeli folk dance in college. I'll leave out all the in-between stuff that went on, but constantly interested in dance. In 1974, Bruce and I were gardening. We had plotted a community farm in Lincoln, Massachusetts, and it was our first garden, which has been a happy history for us. And at the end of the summer, there was a harvest fair with a dance in the barn. And some friends convinced us to join them for this dance. We had no idea what the whole thing was about. Ted Sinella was the caller, and he had a band, probably the Cambridge Country Dance or whatever, the whatever they were called. And there was a barn full of people who didn't know what we were doing. We had a blast. Our faces were sore from grinning at the end of the evening. And at the end of the evening, Ted made an announcement that he calls a regular monthly dance in Concord at the Scout House. It would be the second Saturdays, so starting up in October would be the first dance, so it was a few weeks away. And we said, we're putting it on the calendar. So we showed up at the Scout House, and that was it. We were hooked. And we followed Ted around to his dances, and pretty soon he kind of adopted us. He saw us in the back of that hall the first night, got us into a different square because there were all the beginners in the back of the hall. And he identified us as suckers. So we were very shortly involved with folding NEFA newsletters at his house or at Larry Jennings' house. And he would call us up and say, I have a gig down on the south coast of Massachusetts, and I don't want to drive home by myself late at night. Would you come with me? Keep me company in the car. So we spent time with him, and I would always go home with the calls in my head. I had no intention of being a caller. It would buzz through my brain. And we didn't have any kids at the time, and I think I had toyed, after a couple of years, I toyed with the idea of maybe learning how to be a caller. But in the 1970s, there really were no female callers in this area, maybe other parts of the country. Louise Winston was about the only woman that we knew who called dances. But, you know, she was not part of that tight-knit male group of callers. So I talked to a few people, didn't get any encouragement on becoming a caller in the 1970s, and just let it ride, and then had a couple of kids and thought, you know, who has time for that anyway? So we found ourselves in the late 1980s going to our first full week of camp at Pinewoods. It was Campers Week. And there was a caller's workshop. I thought, oh, I'm not doing anything this hour. I'll take this caller's workshop. It wasn't that successful in that it was very hands-off. We basically sat in chairs and listened to the staff caller lecture. So a year later, we were back at Campers Week, and there was a different caller on staff doing a caller's workshop. And I took that, and we got up and we tried calling dances, but I still was not ready to get anywhere close to a mic. The third year we were at Campers Week, these were all consecutive years with nothing that I was calling in between. I took another caller's workshop with another caller. And at Campers Night, I said to whoever was putting together the program, put me on the last dance of the evening. I'm calling Chorus Jig. And I knew that even if I called it in Mandarin, that crowd would know what to do and it would be fine. So I came back. Campers Week used to always be the last week of the summer. I came back and I went to a dance at the Scout House. It was one of Ted's second Saturday dances. And at the break, I was talking to Larry Jennings. And, you know, at this point, I had known Larry for like 15 years, and Ted also. I was talking to Larry, and I said, I called one dance at Pinewoods. And he said, great, My annual 50th birthday party is coming up in November, and I want you to call a dance. At this point, Ted had walked off the stage. He joins the conversation, and he says, "Great, you'll call Scout House Reel. It's easy, and everybody loves it. You'll be fine." So I had my first dance, you know, in public, considering that Campers Week was more like family than public. And I called Scout House Reel. I have no recollection of how it went, but it must have been okay enough because both Ted and Larry were now full-time pushing behind me. And they would find opportunities for me to get up at the mic. So I could call one dance for a slot at a multi-caller night. Some local callers were very gracious and said, "Well, if you come to my dance, I'll give you one spot." So I was getting little bits of experience, and I was terrified each time. Terrified. I decided that I needed to have another way to get experience that wouldn't terrify me. So my kids were going to the local elementary school, and I knew that I couldn't ask a classroom teacher to give me any time with a class. The gym teacher was wonderful and so beloved that I didn't want to take away the kids' time with him by asking if I could use any gym time. But the music teacher, who was lovely but uninspired, often would ask parents to come into the class and, you know, show their oboe and play it for them or whatever. So I approached her and asked if I could have fourth graders for a number of sessions. And I chose fourth graders because one of my kids was currently in the third grade and I didn't want to have that happen. And I wanted kids who knew their rights from their lefts. So I went in and I had two fourth grade classes back to back, each for a half hour. And we did Galipede and Haste to the Wedding and Heel and Toe Polka. And I thought that if I could teach nine-year-olds how to dance, you have to be pretty clear with what you want with nine-year-olds, then I would be able to address a room full of adults. And I think I had them for 6 weeks, once a week for 6 weeks. And that was such a valuable experience. I learned so much, and I think it really helped take the edge off of my terror. From there, I was pretty much off and running and started to get gigs.
Nice. Yeah, just to fill in a few spots, you know, I'm a little interested in the false start, or I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but you had something of an interest in calling before you had kids. And yeah. Who did you talk to when you're kind of asking around, you know, were you asking other dancers? Were you asking other callers?
Right. Okay. So the interesting bit is that I talked to Ted, and he did share some dances with me. He gave me his cards to copy. But when I said I was interested in calling, he kind of said, "Uh-huh." And, you know, I didn't get any encouragement, and I didn't quite know what to do with that. And I was just not motivated to pursue it. I had at the time approached the adult education programs in the area and asked if I could teach like intro to contradancing to a small group of adults. And I said, but I need 10 people to sign up. And we didn't get 10. So that never happened. So that was really all that happened in the 1970s before I just decided, who has time? I have got kids.
Right. You didn't get like an infusion of enthusiasm that would have pushed you to the next phase. And I think it's significant to what you're saying, you know, about not seeing other women at the mic. And, you know, just when you're going towards something new, I think it helps to be able to see someone like yourself, you know, have that representation.
Right. And, you know, I guess you could call it the glass ceiling. I mean, you know, or even the foot in the door, the foot into the glass door. It just seemed like an impossible thing. So by 1990, 1991, when I was feeling like, well, maybe I want to do this, there were other women callers and, you know, getting gigs in the Boston area. So it just seemed like, well, I let somebody else do the hard work.
Yeah. Well, and it was maybe a good time for you,
and
too.
And it was the right time.
Yeah. And so what do you think was different when you went back to Larry and Ted? You know, it's sort of, in some ways, it just seems like various things were aligning.
Mm-hmm.
But this time, the response was quick. They were ready to
open
the door.
Right. They had known me for a long time. They had known me also as a dance organizer because they had gotten me into it. You know, they're the ones who got me on the NEFA board, and I was arrangements chair for NEFA in the late 70s. I was program chair for NEFA in the early 80s. They had worked with me a lot, and they had confidence that I could do this. So they gave me the opportunities, and they also, Larry was brutal. He was really my mentor. He worked with me a lot. And I'm sure you've heard this from other people. He would let me know on the spot the things that I had done. He would say, "You didn't do your homework." I mean, come right up to the stage. "You didn't do your homework." And it was hard. I'd go home sometimes in tears. Ted called me up one time and said, "You know, there's this dance weekend up in New Hampshire, the Ralph Page weekend. If you apply, we'll give you a scholarship to come." And I got off the phone with him, and about 10 minutes later, the phone rings, and it's Larry. He doesn't even say hello. He says, "Are you coming?" So they were in cahoots. The two of them were working behind the scenes. And it was very interesting because what I think Ted's motive was for getting me to the dance weekend at that time, the callers for that particular Ralph Page weekend were Ted, Tony Parks, Bob Dulcimer. All callers of squares. And I had been calling out for a while. I was calling contras, no squares. And I think they wanted me, I think Ted mostly, wanted me to exposed to fabulous square dance calling and a room full of dancers enjoying it. It was around the time when squares were really slipping in favor, and if a caller said, "Square your sets," there were people who were saying, "No thanks, I'll sit out this dance." So about that time, I got a call from Dan Pearl asking if I wanted to be the staff caller for Labor Day weekend at Pinewoods the following year. And I said, "Yes, but you know, I don't call squares." And he said, "Yeah, well, you've got 18 months to work on it." So people had their agendas. And I was influenced in a good way by all of it, and I had to, you know, had to figure out where I was in the world of what I was going to choose to put on for a dance.
Right, right. And so what was that? What was your personal thread that was kind of leading you through all this? Because, you know, especially hearing you describe the first couple times getting up to call, and every time it's like, oh,
yeah,
you know, but you kept getting back up and you, you know, looked for the way in where you could get more comfortable. So what was keeping you on the track?
Well, I think that terror is a good thing to have. You know, the adrenaline is pumping, and it really it keeps you alive. I remember walking into a dance and seeing another caller as I walked through the hall to get to the stage, and I said, "Does this terror ever go away?" And now I think, you know, oh, calling a night of contras, I could do it blindfolded. So not, I couldn't, but it doesn't have that adrenaline rush. Except now, because of COVID and I haven't called in a long time, there's a little bit of that anxiety that comes with walking back up on stage after being out of practice for a while. What kept me going? The dancers. Always, you know, a new experience. Wherever you call, even if it's the same dance once a month for 10 years, you never know who's going to show up. And you hope people do show up. But it's, you know, it's the call, it's the dancers, it's doing a party dance, it's doing a wedding dance, and thinking, are people going to get up when I say find a partner? And there's that little adrenaline rush that you go into each of those gigs, even if you're not terrified anymore, just the uncertainty keeps you going. In my early days of calling, when, you know, I was scared about going up to the mic, my husband Bruce said, just talk to them like you're talking to people in your living room. And the fact was that I'd been dancing for 15 years with all of these same people, and they were all friends, and I didn't have to think about them as being do you know the cover of Tony Parks's book, where it's taken from the position on stage with all of these dancers looking up like, what? I just felt like they were my friends out there, and I could just talk to them. So it kind of relaxed me to think, I've got a lot of friends out on the dance floor, and now pretty much wherever I go, even overseas, I know these people, and I just feel like they're my buddies.
Something you're doing together.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's good to have that feeling and a feeling of their trust in you, because if you are standing there with confidence and a smile, then you can do all kinds of terrible things. When I was starting to call and I was listening to every word out of all the other callers who ever called on a Thursday night, thinking, that person is making so many mistakes. How are they out there on this dance circuit getting hired everywhere? They make so many mistakes. And I was thinking, they do it with such confidence and with a smile. And that was, you know, to know that people on the dance floor are your allies. You can even try out a brand new dance and say, I'm going to go out on a limb here, but, you know, tell me what you think. And if they trust you because every other dance you're calling that evening is a good one, then you're okay.
Yeah.
This is always the point where there's so many directions
yeah.
I could go, but, you know, using myself as a stand-in for, you know, as someone who has heard a lot about, you know, the Boston dance scene. There's so much that this region and the, you know, the dancers and callers and musicians who have made up the dance scene in this part of the world for, you know, a long time. There's a lot of important sort of foundations here. And so I'm curious to hear from your perspective, just to hear a little bit more about that scene at that time, especially as you were coming up and like really forming close ties to people like Larry Jennings and Ted Sinella. And so I wonder if you can kind of like take us back where you were mostly dancing at the Scout House. Was that the central?
In our earliest days of dancing, we were dancing to Ted at the Scout House. We would go any place. I mean, Roger Why Not had a dance in Belmont, I think. And then the Tuesday night dances in Cambridge were the hot dance. This was VFW. No, this is before the VFW. These were at the Cambridge YWCA in Central Square. And it was a joint effort of NEFA and CDS Boston, I believe. May have just been CDS Boston when they were still, when they still had an American dance part of their program. And Tuesdays were Ted Sinella and Tony Parks on alternating weeks with the very, very beginnings of Yankee Ingenuity playing. I believe this is correct. And it was the hot dance. People came in from out of state every week. It was packed. It was multi-generational. I was in my 20s. Ernie Spence was there. I don't know if you know Ernie, the most beloved of dancers in the Boston area. Everybody wanted to dance with Ernie. He was an old guy. He must have been in his 40s at the time. And there were people in their probably 60s and 70s. Everybody danced. We met everybody. And that was a regular thing. The dance got too big for the hall and moved to the Brimmer and May gym, which was a huge, my recollection is it was vast, and it was in Chestnut Hill. Ted and Tony, I think, were still calling there, and somewhere along the line, Tony Salatan took over a night of that also. So that was a big dance.
And that was weekly.
That was weekly. And somewhere along the line, Todd Whittemore started the Thursday night dances at the VFW. Those were very popular and so crowded that I feared for my safety. I remember thinking I should be going in like football outfits with padding and helmets, because the dancing was enthusiastic and probably a little crazy. But that was a super successful evening. And then, of course, when Todd moved away out of state, NEFA took that over and had an incredible dance. I say we because I came onto the committee sometime after that. We would average 220 dancers a week, and it was the dance to be at. Other dances in the area, Roaring Jelly, which is a large band, always had a dance in the area. It was in Lincoln. It was in Lexington. The Saturday nights at the Scout House were, second Saturdays were Ted, third Saturdays were Beth Parks, fourth Saturdays were Walter Lenk and Debbie Knight. So there was always lots of dancing. I used to tell people you could do this stuff, and if you were an English country dancer and did international or Scottish, you could dance every night of the week.
Yeah, and it sounds like it was especially regional, like a lot of the callers and bands were from the Boston or greater Boston mm-hmm. area. Do you think that is different, you know, if there's maybe a bit more traveling from different areas happening now?
Callers and musicians back then had day jobs. Bob McQuillan was a teacher, a high school teacher. Everybody we knew who was on the circuit around here had day jobs. Nobody was a professional musician or a professional caller. And we didn't have traveling bands. You know, maybe a band came up from the New York area. It was much later. It was into the 1990s, I think. Well into the 1990s, before bands were really on the road and making a circuit up through New England. Mm-hmm. And that meant that local bands had a lot more opportunities and local callers.
Yeah. And a lot of really significant ones.
Yeah.
And, you know, what was the, you know, sort of generational spread? Like, so you at that time, did you feel like you were with, you know, kind of the younger crowd? Was there a sense of, you know, as happens over and over in these sort of traditional art forms, or, you know, did you have a sense of sort of discovery and then kind of making it your own? And did you feel like that was happening in your kind of age cohort? And, you know, what was your perspective on older dancers?
Right. I think we had a true appreciation for the older dancers. I felt like there were plenty of people in our age group. So we never felt shunned because we were the young whippersnappers who didn't know what we were doing. I felt like we were well incorporated. Older people asked us to dance and we didn't feel like they were creepy, which is, you know, something I think about now. We didn't feel like we had to start our own camps or dance series. It was, everybody really was dancing together. Now, we probably had our preferred partners, but, you know, everybody wanted to dance with Ernie, and I can think of a number of other older gentlemen who, like, if they asked me to dance, it was just, oh my God, it's like, yes. They were great dancers, and I think that it's very different now.
And I wonder if, you know, your second time round, when Ted and Larry kind of said, okay, yeah, Sue, like, mm-hmm. let's get you on the road to being a caller. Do you think any of that had to do with just either you, as you said, you really were very, you know, clearly invested in the whole scene, but also I wonder if Ted and Larry were starting to feel like, who's going to keep this going? Do you think there was any of that?
I think there was a lot of that. I remember saying to them, you know, I'm not sure about this. I'd really just rather be dancing. And they said, no, we need you. And I think they saw, so I was 40 or so, and they were probably in their 60s, 70s. I'm not sure how much older they were, but they were probably feeling like we need to get younger people up and now 40 is not so young anymore, but, you know, get the next generation of callers up there, and callers that they felt they had a hand in grooming, so that there was a continuity and that it wouldn't just die off. There was a period of time when, at the VFW, it seemed like we had lost the young ones. So we, through my 40s and 50s, looking at the dance floor, everybody seemed to be my age group, and my 40s and 50s. And we wondered if we were ever going to have a dance population when we got too old to dance, because the young people weren't coming in. And then we had a marvelous influx of young people, thanks to Tom Kruskal and his Morris dancing teams, the kids' teams. They would all come and see each other some other time when they weren't practicing for their Morris teams. They would come and dance together. And Cambridge Revels had brought in a number of young people who wanted to see each other outside of the Revels scene and were showing up. And they brought their friends. And those kids are now all in their 40s. So it was a wonderful influx of new energy.
Yeah, really nice. That's what it takes, those ringleaders sometimes. Yeah. And it sounds like for you as well, did the dance community, did that, you know, spill over into your social scene? And
the dance community was our social scene. When I would say to people, this is my congregation, everybody that I hang out with, people I have Christmas Eve dinner, Thanksgiving Day, everybody that was in our social group were people that we knew from dancing. Our dance community grew because Bruce and I both became involved in Morris dancing in different aspects. I was on a Northwest side. I was on a rapper team. He was playing for Haypenny Morris, a women's Boston team. He joined Pinewoods Morris, Manica. I mean, we expanded, and we were always, during this whole time, we were also doing English country dance. We had started to do that in the 1970s also. So, you know, just the whole Boston area dance scene was our community. Yeah. And, you know, we had had friends from work, we had had friends from grad school, but the dance community was the constant in our lives.
Still is.
It still is. Like, yeah. Absolutely.
Nice. About just, you know, Ted and Larry. I mean, I know it sounds like you had different relationships with them, but, you know, can you just say a little bit more about who they were and how they influenced you?
Sure. Ted was the magician on stage. He could get a room full of people who didn't know what they were doing and having a great time. That was my role model for going out and doing party dances. He would, at a regular dance, at his second Saturday dance, he would come off the stage and he would instruct on good dance style. He would show people how to swing. I mean, he'd take somebody from the crowd and demonstrate in the middle of the hall. Callers aren't really allowed to do that anymore maybe it's coming back a little bit. I mean, you know, the committees that I'm on talk about, let's take a few minutes and do, you know, what the dancers have time for, 30 seconds of a swing demonstration or 1 minute of style tips. But back in my early days of dancing, he would take time and make sure people were dancing beautifully. So he was my model for that. I heard him tell a group one time, a group of callers, your job when you come to a dance as a dancer is to be a good role model on the floor. And I always remember that, you know, if the caller is teaching and I'm on the floor and somebody's chatting with me, I'll say, let's continue this later. Let's let the caller teach the dance. It was a really good thing to hear and to get out there and share with other people. Ted didn't mentor me directly so much. He also moved away from the Boston area about the time that I actually started calling. He and Jean moved to Maine. And whenever I'm in North Whitefield, I walk down the street and visit their grave sites. But I didn't see him that much. And then he became ill. And I believe he died in 1995. And that was only a few years into my calling at that point. Larry was the mentor. He was just going to whip me into shape.
And can you situate him a little bit? Who was Larry Jennings? Because I know him as a choreographer, but he didn't call so much. Is that true?
He wanted to call, but he had an abrasive quality at the mic that didn't put him in great favor with the dancers. So he was an organizer, and he thought about contra dance all the time in a super analytical way. And if you look at the books he published, you will see his lengthy articles. The books have hundreds and hundreds of dances, but they also have all of his articles. And I have notebooks upstairs with printouts of things that he would send me. He sat at a typewriter, and then he sat at a computer, and he had a dot matrix printer, and he would stuff things in envelopes and put them in the mail. So Larry would have been happy to be calling. He had very rigid ideas about what made a good caller. Terminology was first and foremost. And he proudly claimed that he came up with long lines forward and back. What did people used to say? Forward and back. I don't know what people said, but this was, you know, a way for everybody to know which direction they were facing. He claimed to have invented that. He also decided he had some really bad ideas. He thought that California twirl, box the gnat, swat the flea could all be encompassed by twirl to swap. So all you had to do was say twirl to swap. But of course you had to teach what hands were involved, which direction did you end up facing. And he loved to argue. He didn't want to argue so that you were mad at him, but he liked to argue his points. And I was very intimidated by him in my early days. So he would say something like, it has to be twirl to swap, and I'd say, okay. But after a while, I realized, people know what a California twirl is. Why wouldn't I just use that? I wrote my very first contra dance in 1996. Just came to me. I was out for a walk. And it had bits of English country dance moves in it. And it had a turn single. It had a cloverleaf turn single.
And is it Handsome Young Maids?
It was Handsome Young Maids.
I love that.
And I came up to Larry and I said, I wrote a contra dance. He said, what's it got? And I described it. And he said, first of all, he said, what makes that a contra dance and not an English dance? I said, well, you balance and swing. He said, okay. And then he said, what are you going to call that cloverleaf turn single? And I thought, I don't know. So I put it out there to a bunch of callers and said, what would you call this? And I got some recommendations. Scott Higgs suggested that I call it Flirt and Go. So when the dance was first published, I think in the CDSS newsletter, maybe, it was published that way. And, you know, shortly after that, I looked and thought, oh, God, that's terrible. Why don't we just call it a cloverleaf turn single? People who know what a cloverleaf, same way with Box the Gnat, people who know what that term means will know what it means. I still, to this day, demonstrate what it's going to look like because it's a really easy dance, but it has some unusual bits to it. So Larry was always on my case about terminology. He also thought that one walkthrough was your goal, two walkthroughs if absolutely necessary, and if you had to do a third walkthrough, you were a disaster. It was totally the caller's fault for teaching poorly. And I adopted that mindset. And for years and years, for decades, I thought, if I can't do this in one walkthrough, then I'm doing something wrong. I've since walked that back a whole lot and realized that sometimes, a lot of times, people will just feel more comfortable if they get that second walkthrough. But that was another one of Larry's things. Larry had a thing for transitions and certain dance moves, and he did not like right and left through. This was in the context of contras, and he thought promenade across was better. So because he was on my case every week, all the time, about everything, and I was still intimidated, I would take my dance cards and scratch out right and left throughs and call everybody else's dances. And, you know, Tony Parks would show up and say, yeah, that's my dance, but I didn't put a promenade in there. So I love right and left through. It took me a while to realize that Larry was just not right. In my view, my taste, his taste did not always match. But I did learn transitions that didn't work. And this came in handy when I started writing my own dances and realizing, you know, you don't go from a swing into a star. It's not good for anybody. I also, because I came into the caller's job after having danced for at least 15 years, I came in with my own sensibility of what made good dances. And I didn't collect every dance I danced. I pretty much had a policy at the time that I would only call dances that I had danced and that I felt were great. So my dance collection is certainly big enough, but I remember talking to a caller from far away who said, I have 1,500 contras in my collection. And I said, I wouldn't know what to do with 1,500 contras. And also, I can't think of that many that would be worthy of being called. So, my sensibility, along with Larry's influence, was definitely a big factor in what I was calling. I kept lists of everything. I still, at a dance, will write down every dance, and that would certainly come in handy if I had 3 gigs in a weekend, and they were all in the same geographical location, and people would come to more than one dance, and I would say, I'm calling in Rehoboth tomorrow night, but you won't be doing any of these dances. So I still keep those lists, and it's fun to look back and say, wow, I forgot about that dance. That was a good one. I could bring that back into my current pack of dances.
So it sounds like Larry, you know, gave you a lot of structure and things to think about. And then, as I think, hopefully, I hope most mentors, I think, eventually want their mentees to then start to rise into their own place. And you know, then you have that space to say, wait, who am I once I kind of fledge?
Sure. We definitely, at some point, he stopped talking to me about my calling skills. We were working together a lot on his book. I contacted every single dance composer and asked for permission, that for dances that he wanted to publish, and asked for permission. I wrote to a bunch of callers at the time and said, can you give me your 100 top dances that you think have to go into this book? And it was very interesting to see from different geographical locations what the overlap was. There were only a handful of dances that somebody from the Midwest and somebody from California and somebody from New England all felt belonged in that top 100. So I became more of his peer as far as administrative work. And he got off my case. I think probably he stopped listening so closely.
And I'm sure you just, you know, showed yourself to be a highly competent, effective caller. And then
eventually.
Yeah. So, you know, clearly you have so many roots here in your local area, but was there a time when you started traveling farther afield as a caller?
Yeah. That was a total surprise. My first away gig was in California, and it was a local dance musician who was out there playing lots and said, why don't you have Sue come out and call this dance weekend? And if you go far away from home, then somebody else hears you call for the first time, and it just built on that. So the being further afield gave me more connections, to the point where I was traveling some, never as much as, I always had a day job, but I was never traveling to the point where I was on the road all the time. I still had a family at home, and, you know, a few good away gigs in a year were, they made me happy. Yeah. And I think I'm kind of selective about where I want to go, how far away, for how long a period of time. I never considered this my job, and since I wasn't making my living at it, I could say, yeah, well, try me another time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And you touched on this a little bit, but just I just want to track too how dance composing came into this too, and how much of that is part of your, you know, who you are as a caller. Are you still a choreographer?
Yeah. The choreography kind of just came one day. I was out for a walk and handsome young maids just appeared full blown, as is the tune I had called a dance the night before, and the band had played a tune. It was stuck in my head, and I had that tune as I was taking my walk. I don't think I wrote another dance for another few years. And like any choreographers, I think there's a fascination at any given time with a particular move or a particular transition. I never sat down and said, today I'm going to write a dance. I was stuck on Roll Away with a Half Sashay for a while, to the point where I was trying to get it into lots of things. I think callers who are also choreographers should keep a lid on how many of their own dances they call in any given program, because we all have our thumbprint, our signature on our choreography. And, you know, you could tell a Jim Kitch dance because it's all the Haze and Gypsy, right shoulder rounds and Mad Robins now. You know the feel of some dances. So I never sat down. I would just wait for some idea. I've never really looked to invent new moves. I always thought one of the charms of contradancing is that you could come in without classes, even without a beginner session, because the Boston area never had beginner sessions until about a decade ago. We just never had beginner sessions. You could come in, you could count the number of moves back in the 1970s, you could count them on your 10 fingers, and just be dancing. So I was not a proponent of inventing new moves. Some of the new moves are great, but some of the moves that I like the best are from, you know, the Rory O'Moore move or Contra Corners or things like that that are in the repertoire to begin with. So, yeah, steal from what we've already got.
Yeah, that fixed vocabulary. So interesting.
Yeah.
Just to follow up, so Ted and Larry conspired to bring you up to the Ralph Page Dance Weekend, and did you get bitten by the square bug?
Yes, enough so that I now call squares happily. I never had a political agenda about it. I've always felt like I didn't want to be the caller with a political agenda, because there are callers out there with, you know, I will only call X, or I won't go to do a dance weekend if Y. And I thought, whatever you want, I'll do for you. If this makes you and your dance community happy. So I don't try to force them on people. I try to call them the best way I can and only call squares that I would be happy dancing to music that I think is appropriate. There are some bands that I probably wouldn't call a square with, because I like up-tempo, old-time, even if it's a dance written by Ted Sinella. I think the energy is good for squares if it's got a little bit more pep to it. And I love to teach the grand square. And even if I'm in a room where only a few people know what it is, I think I've really honed my teaching on the teaching of a grand square. It's just something you can throw in. The dancers feel really great that they've accomplished something new. And takes up a whole break. You don't have to worry too much about what else to stick in there.
Yep. What's your key that you've discovered in teaching the Grand Square?
In teaching a Grand Square, there are only two people that you need to know in your Grand Square, your partner and your opposite. And that you've always got eye contact with one of them. If you are standing very close to somebody, as in sides face, and you're nose to nose with your partner, the only thing you can do is back up. And if you're standing face to face with somebody who's far away, you should walk forward. So that's pretty much my Grand Square.
Yeah. It's so true. It's so satisfying when it all clicks.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, I'd love to get a little bit, you know, into the craft of calling, or, you know, mm-hmm. more what you've honed over the years in terms of teaching and how you see the role of the caller, because it's such a curious thing. You know, what is it about calling for you that has, you know, made it so central in your life, and how do you think about it?
Yeah. Well, of course, the reason to do this is for the dancers. You know, it has just brought so much joy to me and my family and my close community and the greater community that I do it to keep it going. And I developed my own repertoire. I pulled the dances into my own repertoire. I think it's important to know your repertoire, and not to know it so that you can call it without cards. I think that's crazy. I only know two people. I think one of them's no longer with us, but people who could walk into a hall without any calling aids and pull off a whole evening. I'm not recommending anybody aspire to that, but I think you should know your repertoire so that if you say, I think what we need right now is a dance with something completely different than what we just did, let's do X, because it will be a nice juxtaposition with something that they've just finished. So that also takes me into programming. I used to sit down and put together programs before I would go to a dance. And then, of course, you had to throw away most of it because three dances in, a busload of students would come in. They didn't know what they were doing, and you'd have to just go back to the beginning and pull out a very basic, you know, Scout House reel or something. I sometimes put together a list of dances, of possible dances that I can choose from, but I very rarely, and this is, you know, pre-COVID 3 years ago, will sit down and craft a program. Unlike English country dance, where you absolutely put together a program, and, you know, musically it's a different story. I like the band to have a good hand in crafting the evening. So if the piano player in particular, who I happen to be living with, turns to me and says, "What kind of jigs do you want for the next dance?" I'll say, "Oh, jigs, good idea." And I'll look through the list or go through my mental Rolodex and come up with a dance that I like to do with jigs. If I've already got a dance that I want to do planned for that next slot, and the band says, "Can we play, you know, Irish reels? Can we play elegant marches?" I'll either say, "Hold that for later," or, "Sure, let's try it," because I think, unlike English country dance, where every dance has its dedicated tune, a good contra dance is just a different experience when it's done to different style of music. And I feel like working with the band is such an exciting element of being on stage. I've gotten to work with such amazing musicians. I feel so lucky. And if I'm working pretty much with any band, whether I know them or not, before the dance starts, I will ask them, is there anything in particular you want to get to tonight? Because maybe they have some very unusual Eastern European sounding medley that they want to get to. And I'll say, okay, I'll find something that goes with that. On the wonderful occasions when I got to work with Nightingale, or basically any band that Becky and Keith were in, they knew that they could sit down with me for 5 minutes before the dance and say, here's what we want to do. And I would program on the fly to match their musical program. That was a rare occasion, but also a great adrenaline rush to be able to come up with a dance that I could sort through and find just what I thought was going to work with what they had in mind. I got a lot of good feedback on how to work with musicians from living with a musician, and also just talking to a lot of musicians that I've worked with over the years. There was, one thing that I've learned being on stage, this is a much more involved piece here, but I always felt like I was in a rush, and that put the bands in a very hard place, especially if it was an established band like Yankee Ingenuity on a Monday night would always have a guest musician sitting with them. And they would have to find common repertoire in between each dance. Well, if I was ready to line up the dancers and start teaching it right away, that didn't give them enough time to come up with the medleys for the next dance. So I don't tell jokes. I am really bad at forgetting punchlines. And I realized that if you only did 11 dances in the course of a whole evening, nobody was going to ask for their money back. I took a step back and decided, you don't have to rush. Nobody's clocking me up here. So that all ties in with working with the band, giving everybody what they need on stage, on the dance floor, and taking more time for the walkthrough, which part of, at some point, I used to do a one-shot caller's workshop in aiming for that one walkthrough teach. And the first thing I would say is, make sure everybody's ready. And some callers have little tricks. Take hands four, circle left. And, you know, to trick people into shutting up and doing something where the dance doesn't actually have a circle at the beginning of it. I just wait until people are ready. I don't wait forever. I'll say, give me a hands up at the bottom of the hall. Give me a thumbs up when you've got your hands four down there. And when you're teaching, is everybody doing the same part of the dance? Has everybody finished that chain and the half hay? Are they ready to hear the tricky bit that comes next? And you want everybody in the same place. Are you all still opposite your partner? Are you all still next to your partner? So taking that extra 2 seconds to make sure everybody's ready to hear what comes next. You know, so maybe in the course of a walkthrough, you've used up another 15 seconds. It's no big deal, and you can then go right into the dance.
Yeah. It's like really thinking of the dance as a whole organism, right? Kind of, it seems like.
Yeah. And, you know, having the musicians be happy with you is a good thing.
Besides, you know, we've talked a lot about Ted and Larry, but as you were learning, did you have other either mentors or just people whose style you studied a little bit?
Well, I must say the people were very generous there. When I got my first gig calling at a party that was going to be more than just the handful of dances that I taught to those fourth graders, I needed more party material. And Tony and Beth Parks invited me over to their house and did just like a brain dump. You have to have this dance, and this dance always works, and this is no fail. And people were very generous. As far as styling myself, I think a really good thing is to just be yourself. I thought that I had to pitch my voice lower, and that didn't work for me. My vocal cords would seize up in a dance. I just had to speak my own speaking voice when I'm calling. I think vocal quality is a really important characteristic of a good caller. You get somebody like Tony who just has the velvet voice, and Susan Kevra is like late night radio. She could sing you to sleep. Not that she put me to sleep, but just some great callers' voices. And I think vocal quality, also vocal delivery. I cannot stand it when people do the up talk thing, circle left. Are you asking me or are you telling me? So there are things that I find comforting in hearing a caller give you the statement, end it with a period. I like to hear a caller who has a musical quality in their voice. And it doesn't have to be singing. Singing squares are one thing, but a vocal quality that rises and falls and isn't a dead monotone. And I think rhythmic, along with the musical quality is the rhythmic quality of a call, not just 5-6 circle left, but something that puts it into the rhythm of the dance, join hands 4 and circle left. So there are, I don't think I actually styled myself with anybody in particular in mind. And I never made recordings of other callers to work on from there. But I, as I say, I had done a lot of dancing before I got in front of a mic.
Yeah, so lots of influences, but big and small, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah, and what about, you mentioned teaching workshops sometimes, but do you see yourself as a mentor?
I've taught callers courses, not intensive, but an hour a day at camps. This past summer, I was on staff with a caller. I was calling English, and this caller who was on staff to call American said, "I did my first caller's workshop with you here at this camp. 15 years ago, whatever it was. So that's great. There was a period of time, I've lost track of time, maybe 20 years ago, when I offered a caller's class at my house. And I think I had 6 people who came, and we had a number of sessions. And the front hall is kind of like an open space. And we called for each other. And some of those people went on to call dances. And some just wanted the experience of finding out what callers talk about, think about, and what it's like to call to a small group of people. And I was able to give a few of those people slots at the NEFA Contra Nights, which are a multi-caller evening. But no mentorship in a big way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything else about the caller's role? You know, we've talked about sort of teaching and language and voice. Are there other things that aren't specifically about, you know, how to do the moves and when to do the moves, but, you know, how else are you kind of holding a group of dancers as a caller?
Each gig is different, and I think about them all differently. I think my favorite gigs are those for total non-dancers, because the look on their faces when they're having such a blast, and it's just so rewarding to see people get into it. So there are, you know, there are the one-night stands where each of them is a total unknown. And then there's the community where I know that I'm going to know everybody's name on that dance floor. There are 25 to 30 people who come to this dance every month. And we have a potluck dinner, and I know what I ate that one made. And it's, you know, it's kind of like calling for a family. I want to pull out the stuff. I know that dancer loves the Petronella move. I'm going to make sure that for tonight's program, I have a dance. Before she leaves, I'm going to put in a dance that has one of those. I know that those dancers love singing squares. I'm going to make sure that we get one of those in before they leave at the break. I want everybody to go home with a smile on their face. And I want people to be safe. And I know that sometimes dancers come up and they say, oh, you know, you called a dance that had make an arch and the sides duck through, and I can't make that arch. My arms don't do that. And I keep that in mind. You know, when that dancer is on the floor, there aren't going to be any arches tonight.
Yeah, lots of little ways to care for the right group.
And I want people who want to dance to be out there on the dance floor. As an organizer, I have heard people say, I came to the dance and I couldn't get a partner. Or I came to this dance week and nobody asked me to dance. And I want anybody who wants to dance be up on the dance floor. I think it's gotten better since we are moving away from gendered terminology. I think more people see, I can dance with that person. I can dance any role in this room. It bothered me to think that somebody was waiting to be asked. I am a big proponent of taking care of yourself. And if you want to dance, go ask somebody. And if they aren't dancing, find somebody who's standing up and ask them. If somebody's sitting down, maybe they need to rest. But I think that people shouldn't be waiting to be asked. It sounds very 20th century to me to wait to be asked to the prom. Go ask somebody if you want to do something and ask until you find a partner. So I want people to be up and dancing. I do direct people to the sides of the hall. Ask somebody you don't know. Ask somebody who you've never met before. I've gotten great partners by going someplace totally new and dancing with somebody I thought, well, let's give this a shot. And, oh, heavenly partners. So I just want people to have a great time.
Yeah.
And I think that my role as a caller is more to be transparent and just to enable the dance to happen, you know, except in a one-night stand where, you know, you have to really be out there. But a great deal of the enjoyment that people have in coming out to a dance is dancing with their friends and finding new friends to dance with. And the second biggest thing is the music. That you can have a really bad caller calling bad dances, and if the music is great, people are dancing with their friends, they're going to have a good time. So my role as a caller, I think, is to not be in people's faces, to teach efficiently, call a few times, step gradually out, make sure everybody's where they need to be in the dance, and just let them dance to the music and dance with their friends. That's my biggest role. I don't have shtick. I know that there are people who are known for their stage personalities, and that's great. I don't have that. Along with not telling jokes, I don't wear hats. I don't clog while I'm calling. And I want the band to be happy. I want the band dancer connection to be happening. And I just step out of the way.
You just come as you are. You come as Sue Rosen.
That's what you get.
Dance caller. Yeah. What else would you need?
Yeah.
How's the future looking? And, you know, let's recognize that we're in this funny moment where, of course, no dancing happened for for some years and, you know, and now it's starting up again. But taking all that into consideration, but also, you know, with a longer view, when you look ahead, what are you excited for yourself? And how do you feel like the dance community is faring?
I am looking with great interest to see how the community is faring. I know that I can't use the words post-pandemic because for me, we're still in it. But when some of our local dances started up again, I know that the Bida dance had over 200 people at their first dance. And I wanted to push my calling off until later in the spring because I was confident that the COVID numbers were going to go down, not back up like they did. But when I was there, there were 100 some. It was a lovely evening. But I think that initial euphoria about getting back onto the dance floor maybe has waned and people are slipping back into their pandemic comfort of not running out at night. I know I got used to having a dinner and putting on my slippers and not getting in the car a bunch of nights a week. So I'm very interested and concerned about the future of our dance communities. I'm hoping that we build back up. I'm not expecting to come back because the Thursday night dance here has not yet started. It will be starting after a false start in the spring. We will be starting in a few weeks. I'm not expecting a huge crowd. I think people are still tentative about the safety issues. And a lot of us have aged. Some of us have gotten our new joints and have maybe found other things to do. I'm hoping that we come back, we get another generation that will move up at some point. I don't have fears that social dancing is dying out, not like I did 25 years ago when I thought, you know, we don't have a young population. But having been at dance camps this summer, I can see that there's still great enthusiasm across the generations for what we're doing. As far as for myself, I seem to be calling a lot more English these days, which, even though I've been calling English for 20 years now, continues to be a surprise. And I love it. I still, something that I have long, long wanted to do, and who knows, I may just get to do this, is to have an evening program, once a month maybe, of mixed American and ECD. Years ago, Larry Jennings said, why don't you just do it? And I remember asking a bunch of people, would you do this? And, you know, there were all the contra dancers who said, oh, no, I don't do ECD. It's so boring. And a bunch of English dancers who said, oh, no, I don't like contra. They can't count to eight. And I remember asking the late Mary Kay Friday, would you go to an English-American evening? And she said, oh, no, I wouldn't know what to wear. Do I wear my long, elegant skirts or do I wear my short, swirly ones? And I thought that was the best answer yet. But CDS Boston used to have occasional party dances that were a mix of both. And the only places where I can go do both now are at camps. So I would still love to have an evening dance. And maybe within the next few years, I will make that happen in the Boston area. That's something that I would like to do with my organizing skills and, you know, sharing the calling with other people.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I think it's always good to have a little something you're working towards, yeah, or just, you know, keeping it fresh. Well, I have three closing questions that I've been asking everybody.
Okay.
If you're up for it. I don't think they'll be too shocking.
Okay.
The first is touching back on the caller as kind of cataloger or archivist. How do you keep your dances? I'm guessing it's not on an iPad, but I don't know.
It is not on an iPad. I started off with 3x5 index cards. I don't like when a caller holds a card up right in front of their face. It's a barrier between me and the dancers. So I put my dances into my computer, and I print them out in 24-point font and punch holes, and they live in three-ring binders. And I can put them, with that size font, I can put them on the floor and just see them and have my hands free so that I can gesture and hold the mic if I want. And I don't have any barrier there. My dances are organized alphabetically. So people who have cards and they're color-coded and they have dividers in their card files for, you know, dances that are Beckett's, I never understood the necessity to separate Beckett's from any other duple minor dances. But they're alphabetical, and that's why I really need them organized in my head. So that if I say, oh, I need a dance that has a Petronella move, I can call Princeton Petronellas. I can call Joel's in the Kitchen. I know the dances that will fall into the slots that I need, and they're alphabetical. It became evident about 10 years ago that I was traveling more on airplanes to do gigs, and I needed a way to not be hauling my three-ring binders with me. So I had all of these dances in Word docs, and I just sent them to a Kindle. So I don't have an iPad, which would be great because then you can just do a search for things. A very old style Kindle, first generation Kindle, has a terrible file management system. And I have, how many Contras on here? 350 Contras on here, 248 English country dances, 68 odd formations. So they are broken down only into very broad categories. And when I want to call a dance that starts with the letter W and it's sorted alphabetically, I have to page through many, many times to get down to where it is a terrible thing. I should just invest in an iPad, but I'm not in great enough need, I guess. So when I have a local dance, it's my three-ring binders. And when I get on an airplane, this is, I take my little Kindle with me.
The trusty, very portable.
Very portable, holds a charge for a really long time.
Yep, and it's true. Sometimes just the systems that we establish and then work with over some time, you'd rather stay in the comfort zone.
Yeah, but the book, the big book, the three-ring binder, made an impression on Dudley Laufman once. He insists, and every time I see him, which isn't very often recently, but he insists that I have this binder that I throw on the floor. And I'm sure I have never actually thrown my binder on the floor, but that made a big impression on him.
You know, if it's a sizable binder, I can see that maybe it might make a sound when you place it on the floor. I don't know. Makes a good story, though.
It does. And he's a good storyteller.
Exactly. Do you have any pre or post gig sort of rituals or things that you do to get in and out of the caller zone?
Because I used to have trouble with my voice seizing up, I have a friend who is a voice teacher, and I went and talked to her. This goes back 25 years ago. I said, I'm calling a dance, especially a square, and all of a sudden, nothing is coming out. It's a terrible feeling. And she told me, hydrate, hydrate, hydrate. And not just before you go to the dance and not just with a bottle of water next to me, like for 48 hours before a gig, make sure that your vocal cords are hydrated. She also gave me some vocal exercises to do, and I would sit in the car and do sing weird scales, you know, screechy scales, just to exercise my vocal cords before I would show up at a dance. I don't really have rituals. I talk to the band when I get there, just give hugs around to the ones I know and try to get out of their way because they're doing a sound check. I always bring up my own windscreen. And I ended up buying them in packages of 8 because I often leave them on the mic at the end of the evening, mistakenly leaving them there. I think it's a good hygienic way of not having my lips on the same microphone as whoever used it last night from a different gig. And since I think I speak rather clearly and I can pop my peas, it kind of muffles that. Pro tip, when you're wearing an N95 mask, you don't need a windscreen because it just does the trick. Post-gig, nothing. I try to just calm myself in the car on the way home so that I can actually fall asleep. Usually it's, I'm kind of excited about the evening. If there were mistakes, which are not so much more recently, well, not and nothing's recently, but, try to talk myself down from anything that I feel I'm going to be beating myself up over for a long time.
Yeah, don't spend too much time there.
Yeah. Well,
I'm familiar with that. That's definitely in my post-gig ritual, right. Too. And then lastly, do you think of yourself as an introvert or an extrovert, if you know?
Oh, I think it's easy for me. I've never been tested, but I'm an extrovert. I love being around people. And, I always have that fear of missing something. So I love being at camps. I get to meet new people. I think I soak up my energy from, I think that's the definition of an extrovert. I soak up my energy from other people.
Do you think in any way, you were drawn to calling because of it? It put you kind of in a space where you could be with other people's energy, or does that not connect so much?
Maybe not so much because I was going out to the dances all the time. There was a year when I couldn't dance. I had a foot injury and I was instructed to not dance. But I went to the Thursday night dance every week and just sat on the bar in the back and hung out. There was always somebody who was sitting out to dance for one reason or another. And there was always somebody to hang out and talk to, or I would sit on the side and talk to Larry Jennings. And we would talk about the people on the dance floor. Oh, she needs to learn how to swing. I don't think calling, I don't think I wanted to put myself out there. I just like to be with a lot of people, or be with two people, one person, anybody.
Yeah. Great. Well, I think we'll leave it there if that feels good to you.
That's fine.
Well, Sue, thank you so much. This was so fun.
This was great fun.
It's great to get to visit with you and again to see you in person. And thank you so much.
Well, it was a blast.
Thanks again to Sue for talking with me. Check out the show notes at podcasts.cdss.org to learn more. This project is supported by CDSS, the Country Dance and Song Society, and is produced by Ben Williams and me, Mary Wesley. Thanks to Great Meadow Music for the use of tunes from the album Old New England by Bob McQuillan, Jane Orzechowski, and Deanna Stiles. Visit podcasts.cdss.org for more info. Happy dancing!
The views expressed in this podcast are of the individuals and do not necessarily reflect those of CDSS.